cried so loud and so hard, the nurse had to come over and ask me to leave. "Dad, wake up! Wake up, Dad, now! You can't go now! Please wake up! We need you! I love you! No!" I was forced to leave the room because of my behavior. And when I did, I was taken to a different room full of chairs with two huge glass windows. I saw these windows and started to charge at them. If my dad was going to die, why should I stay alive? My life meant nothing without my dad. My dad had a long, rugged recovery. Coming in and out of the hospital was very scary and frightening for all of us. To this very day, my dad has trouble speaking. He is having seizures and doesn't remember things too well. But he is in much better condition than he was in before. The bullet is still in his head simply because it couldn't be removed, which makes me fear that something could go wrong at any time. I sympathize with people who have lost a parent, or both for that matter. I understand the fear that overcomes someone when a loved one is lost. He isn't the only one living with the scar, because I am also. Even though I am living with his scar, I sit back every day and remember that it is only a scar, and count my blessings that my dad is still alive. Diary 113. Dear Diary, nothing hurts more than celebrating your mother's birthday on Christmas Eve when she's not around. It's been 8 days since my mother passed away. Today, she would have been 48. The holiday season is supposed to be a time of happiness that you can spend with your family, but this year turned out to be tragic. Normally, since Christmas Eve is my mother's birthday, she would get twice as many presents. I told her that this year would be different because she wouldn't have to do anything on her birthday. I was wrong. When she went to the doctor for an appointment a month earlier, the doctor told her that she had a serious illness and that she had about 3 months to live, if not less. It turned out to be 3 weeks. My mother died from terminal cancer. I knew this was going to happen after I found out she was sick. I just didn't think it would happen so soon. I was hoping she could spend Christmas with the family one last time. Just like last year, we were going to open up a couple of gifts on Christmas Eve and then the rest on Christmas morning. That was our tradition every year. Now all this has changed. This year we didn't get a tree. There might not be a Christmas dinner. And I don't know what to do with my mother's gifts. What should I do with them? Should I keep them? Get rid of them or give them to my sister? I don't know. I know that while other people are opening their gifts, I'll be packing up my mother's things in boxes. With my mother dying so suddenly and unexpectedly, I didn't get the chance to talk to her. It's the worst thing that could ever happen because I never had the chance to say goodbye. I have no closure. No, I love you. Ms. Gruel once said that timing is everything, and her death couldn't have come at a worse possible time. During my senior year, a week before Christmas, and a few months before graduation, my mother died on December 16th. That day, I knew something was going to happen because when I got to school, something inside me didn't feel right. When I came home, I noticed something new. She was on a respirator. But for some reason, I thought nothing of it. I thought it was just another piece of her medical equipment she got from the hospital because each week she got something new. So I went to my room to prepare for our Freedom Rider holiday party that was taking place later that evening. As I was about to leave, my neighbor, who was visiting my mother at the time, yelled my name frantically from the other room. She told me that my mother had just passed away. I couldn't believe her. I had to see for myself. As I walked toward her room, I could hear my sister crying. Then I saw my mother, and I froze for a moment. I couldn't do anything but stare. She was lying lifelessly in her bed. I knew deep down that if I had cried at that moment, I would have lost my mind. Now I have unanswered questions and a lack of resolve. I am instantly an adult. Who's going to be there for me when I need help? I am alone. I don't have a parent living with me. I have no guidance. Ms. Gruel and the Freedom Riders want to help me get through my difficult time, but I keep pushing them away. I always tell them, I'm okay, and I'm fine. Don't worry about me. But the truth is, I'm not okay, and I'm nowhere near being fine. I don't know why I won't let anyone in my life. I don't know why I won't ask for help. I was always taught that people don't give without receiving. Now I need to make the choice to open up and not push people away. Being a freedom rider has taught me that people do so much without asking people for anything in return. Maybe they could help me get through my loss. And in return, I could open up to them and accept them as my second family. Then I won't be so alone.
Here's what the newspaper said about us. Some of the headlines. Cathartic writing course chronicles students' pain. Teens honored for rising above background to become advocates for tolerance. Literature transforms student toughs. Writing to heal. Teenage freedom writers explore their problems through writing. Teaching tolerance. Escape. Visitor tells students how she eluded Nazis by posing as another family's daughter. Woman who hid Anne Frank is guest of Wilson High students. Honoring Anne Frank, Holocaust. Woman who hid the girl from Nazis brings her own story to Long Beach. Truth stronger than friction. Troubled teens find hope amid Holocaust. Bosnia's Anne Frank Zlata tells experiences to Wilson High. Teen Bosnian diarist brings history to life. Visit. Girl sits in on classes at Wilson High School in Long Beach. Students say they can identify with her war-torn childhood. She opened their eyes, and they opened up their lives. Education. Erin Gruel used the Holocaust to teach students about tolerance. Then they filled a book about horrors of their own. Inspiring the students, freedom writers, teens talk about hard work, goals, pursuing dreams now. Civil writers, teacher, student authors pitch tolerance book in New York.
Senior year, spring, 1998. Entry 8, Ms. Gruel. Dear Diary, we just returned from Christmas vacation, and I just got a call congratulating the Freedom Writers for winning the Spirit of Anne Frank Award. The Anne Frank Center USA honors those who have followed the courage of their convictions to step forward and actively confront anti-Semitism, racism, prejudice, and bias-related violence in their community. But there's a catch. We have to accept the award in person next Thursday in New York. During my college craze in October, I encouraged the students to apply for scholarships. I saw an advertisement in Scholastic Scope magazine promoting the Spirit of Anne Frank scholarship for students who combat discrimination in their own communities. It sounded too perfect to pass up, so I entered all 150 students as one entity. As I was filling out the application, my competitive side kicked in, and I was convinced that my students had to win. The day the Anne Frank Center received our application, a woman named Beatrice called and said she'd been crying in her coffee all morning because our application was so amazing. She went on to explain that the application was totally unorthodox because the center only picks individuals, not groups. She wanted to know if I would resubmit my application and pick only one student as a representative of the group. I said no. We're a package deal. It's all or nothing. In November, I went to New York and met with people from the center. We were clearly the front runners to win the award, but the center was in a precarious position. How would we get the Freedom Writers to New York? I said, hey, If we win, somehow, some way, I'll find a way to get the kids here. Coincidentally, while I was in New York, the LA Times article about the Freedom Riders reran in a New York paper. When I got home on Sunday, my answering machine was filled with messages. I don't know how they tracked me down, but all these TV shows, magazines, and newspapers called, wanting to do a story on us. It was all very surreal since we've lived in virtual anonymity for 3 years, and in one weekend we suddenly had the opportunity to win an award and now perhaps to appear on a TV show. I tried to keep all the TV shows at bay until I could process everything. But when Connie Chung called during my third period class, I knew in my heart that she would be the best person to tell our story for ABC's Primetime Live. I've got less than 10 days to figure out how to get my students to Manhattan, meet Connie Chung, and maintain a sense of normalcy. The more attention we're getting, the more protective I've become. I feel like a mockingbird, dive-bombing anyone who wants to disrupt the dynamics of Room 203. If I feel they have ulterior motives or are the slightest bit disingenuous, I try to shelter the kids from them. Even though we don't have hotel or plane reservations yet, something tells me that we'll find a way to be on a plane next week. The clothing company Guess actually called me after the article ran in the LA Times, offering to help our cause. Maybe I'll start with them to see if they can help me get some students to New York to accept this prestigious award in person.
Diary 114. Dear Diary, I just got home from the Guess headquarters in L.A. Earlier in the week, Ms. G told us that they had decided to sponsor the Freedom Riders and fly 45 of us to New York City to accept the Spirit of Anne Frank Award in person. I was fortunate enough to be one of the students picked to go. As soon as I got home, I was so excited. I told my mother that we met the Guess staff and how they surprised us with gifts and gave us a brief history of the company. We also found out why they wanted to sponsor our trip to New York. I learned that the Marciano brothers, who are the founders, are Jewish, and their father was a rabbi. During the Holocaust, their family had to flee Europe. I was very enthused and ready for the trip, so I decided to call my father and explain that I was leaving tomorrow. He didn't ask me if I was prepared for New York. He didn't offer to take me shopping or even give me any money for the trip. Nothing. After a disappointing conversation with him, I started to think. It's a shame how a company that does not even know me personally is willing to help me so much. Yet I have a father who knows who I am, where I live, my telephone number, and he acts like I don't exist. For 18 years, his off-and-on actions have made an impact in my life. My father always promises me things and never comes through, which has made it hard for Mom at times since she's a single mother. During the holidays, he does bring me gifts, but when I really needed him to provide for me, he would act like he couldn't help me. I only ask him to help me when I have no other choice. When I do, he procrastinates or tells me to ask my grandmother. It's not that I always want money from him. I want a supportive father figure in my life, someone to be there in my corner. I always wondered why he never took time out to spend with me. Receiving Guess clothes for our trip reminded me of my childhood and how I needed designer clothes to make me feel accepted by others in school. While everyone was wearing Nike and cross colors, I was wearing Pro Wings and swap meet specials. Wearing them made me feel that I wasn't accepted by anyone, not even myself. I didn't accept myself because I didn't have the right clothes. Sad, isn't it? Don't get me wrong. I was grateful for the clothes that I had on my back, but I just wanted to have designer clothes as well. Since my father wasn't making me feel wanted at home, I really needed to feel accepted by my peers at school. But in the end, for me to feel accepted by them, I felt like I had to have the same things they did. Now that I am part of something like the Freedom Riders, I don't have to try to fit in or to buy my way into acceptance. Material things are no longer a top priority in my life, Of course I want nice things, but I don't feel as if I have to have them to feel complete. It's funny how material things mean so much to adolescents. The problem is people grow up thinking that material things are what makes them worthwhile, which is very untrue and causes them to be very shallow. Now, as a young adult, I've realized that love is more important than material things. Material things can't love you like a father can.
Diary 115. Dear Diary, it's always been a dream of mine to go to New York. One of those dreams that is always nice to think about, but that you know deep down inside will never come true. New York is where the action is. Busy people rushing around on the sidewalk in a hurry to get to work, taxis speeding and honking as they zoom by, the huge billboards and booming lights in Times Square, and famous monuments like the Statue of Liberty and the Empire State Building. I just got a phone call from Ms. Gruel saying that I should plan on packing my bags because I was one of the Freedom Riders chosen to represent the group at the Spirit of Anne Frank Award in New York City. In order to be eligible to accept the award, we had to write an essay explaining why we would be good ambassadors for the occasion. We only had one day to write the essay, so it was difficult for me to pinpoint what I wanted to say in so little time. I tried to act so calm when Ms. Gruel called me. I didn't want to sound too eager. But the second I hung up the phone, everything clicked and I realized what she had told me. Her words echoed over and over in my mind. Pack your bags. Pack your bags. Pack your bags! Wow! I actually get to go to New York. I've got to pack. I need more time. Ah! I need to go to the mall. There are so many things I need to get. I need a heavy jacket. I heard it's really cold in New York now. It's been snowing there a lot lately. I'm so surprised that I'm one of the 45 Freedom Riders that was chosen to go to New York. At the beginning of the year, I wasn't too sure if I would even be able to get into the class. The demand was so intense that only a handful of people were selected to join the class senior year. The majority of the students have had Ms. Gruel since they were freshmen. Since some of my friends had been in the class for their entire high school career, each week they had something new to say about the class and about Ms. Gruel. They only had awesome things to say, never anything negative. My friends would tell me that they would meet a famous author one week, and the next they would read a really interesting book. They could tell Ms. Gruel anything and everything, almost like she was one of the kids. She understood them. Most teachers aren't like that. They give you your homework and then send you on your way, never getting to know you. Some of my former teachers have had four or five favorite students in the class and overlooked the rest entirely. Ms. Gruel is so much different. She gets to know you. She wants to get to know you. Despite all the positive stuff, I had mixed feelings about getting into the class. I was totally ecstatic about being a part of something that I'd heard so many wonderful things about, but I was completely terrified. For some reason, I thought that everyone in her class would hate me because I joined the group after they'd been together for 3 years. I didn't want to be an outsider. I soon learned that there was nothing to worry about. As the year progressed, I have figured out that the others accepted me as one of their own. It's almost as if they've adopted me into their family. A family that knows no color lines and only sees what lies deep within your heart. Diary 116. Dear Diary, the first night in New York was exciting. We arrived and all I could think about was bumping into somebody famous. Our stay was going to last 4 days. Everyone was anxious to get started with our schedule. The ride from the airport to the Marriott Hotel was absolutely breathtaking. I tried to contain my excitement, but was not able to. "Oh my God," I said. All of us could not believe how beautiful the skyline looked. New York seems like a magical place where anything can happen. Ms. Gruel has been working for Marriott International for many years to support our outings. I thought the New York Marriott Marquis was so luxurious. The view was magnificent. We were right in the middle of Times Square. Taxicabs roamed the streets of New York and lights covered every inch of the city. The Marriott staff made us feel right at home. When we went to Washington, D.C., Ms. Gruelle let everybody choose his or her own roommates. In Washington, D.C., it was obvious to Ms. Gruelle that everybody chose the people they felt more comfortable with. New York is going to be different, she explained. This time around, she was going to choose our roommates for us. Ms. Gruelle can never do things a simple way. She always has some big teaching scheme, even when we are nowhere near a classroom. The room situation ended up being one of the best lessons of my life. The first night in our room scared me because there were four girls, three being of different races. The only reason I felt uncomfortable was because I have never experienced sharing a room, a bed, or a bathroom with people outside of my race. When I was a little girl, I had three best friends who happened to be Chinese, African American, and Caucasian. They had sleepovers all the time, but I never attended any of them because my father did not allow it. He always told me that he had provided a house for me to sleep in and that I had no business sleeping in someone else's house. I soon began to wonder whether my father was old-fashioned or prejudiced. I did not know about my father's true feelings until I was 15 years old. My older sister had a boyfriend who was African American. One night, my sister and father had an argument. I heard him say that if she ever married her boyfriend, he would never give her his blessing. It was depressing to hear, but the truth finally came out about him. He was prejudiced, and it hurt. Now, all of a sudden, in New York City, my roommates were ironically African American, Caucasian, and Asian, just like my best friends back in elementary school. I felt very uncomfortable changing in front of them at first, especially sleeping in the same bed with an Asian girl. All I could think about was my father. I woke up the next day tired and restless. We all took showers in the morning and walked down to breakfast on time. There was hardly any communication between us the first evening, but the second night would be different. After a long day in the city, we finally returned to our hotel rooms. We were hungry and decided to order room service, but we didn't have any idea what we were getting ourselves into. Three hamburgers, two fries, one chicken sandwich, and drinks ended up costing us $43.11. New York was expensive, and we could not stop laughing at the cost. After we ate, we started talking, and before we knew it, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. The next day, we began to share clothes, shoes, toothpaste, and even deodorant. My experience made me realize my father's beliefs were wrong. I felt a strong bond grow between me and my roommates. I believe that I will never again feel uncomfortable with a person of a different race. When I have my own children someday, the custom I was taught as a child will be broken, because I know it's not right. My children will learn how special it is to bond with another person who looks different but is actually just like them. All these years, I knew something was missing in my life. And I'm glad that I finally found it.
Diary 117. Days like this create memories worth living for. My day began with tears of happiness after receiving the Spirit of Anne Frank Award, and ended with tears of sadness after watching the play of The Diary of Anne Frank on Broadway. The Freedom Writers also had the privilege to meet and bond with prestigious people and some New York City high school students. At breakfast, the Freedom Writers were exhausted from staying up late the night before, but we were looking forward to receiving the award. Later that day, when we arrived at the ceremony, all eyes were set upon us. The award had never been presented to so many people at one time, and this showed the true symbolism of our cause. We were the last ones on the program to receive the award. One of the recipients of the award was Gerald Levin, CEO of Time Warner, and we were honored to win an award with a powerful millionaire like Mr. Levin. When it was our turn, a majority of us were already crying. Linda Lavin, the actress who plays Miss Van Dan in the play, made us cry even more when she said we made her feel proud to be part of the human race. She read a list of our accomplishments so that the audience could understand what we were all about. When she said, "How proud I am standing here looking at you," the rest of the Freedom Riders lost it. We were bawling. Later in the evening, we walked from our hotel rooms to the theater to watch The Diary of Anne Frank, starring Natalie Portman and Linda Lavin, on Broadway. Everyone dressed up with nice dresses, slacks, and ties. The guys looked so handsome and the girls beautiful, as always. After the play, Linda Lavin invited us to stay to meet all of the cast members, which made it even more meaningful. Winning the Spirit of Anne Frank Award and seeing the Broadway play made me realize what Anne meant when she wrote in her diary, "I want to go on living even after my death."
Diary 118. Dear Diary, tomorrow we are leaving New York to head home. In the last 3 days, I have seen places I never dreamed I'd see, and I have met people I never thought I would meet. A month ago, I had no idea I would visit New York City, and now here I am, staying in a huge Marriott right in the middle of Times Square. I've lost count of all the places I have been. We have been all over the city, riding the subway and walking. We went to Rockefeller Center for the Spirit of Anne Frank Award ceremony. We toured Scholastic, Inc. We met the CEO, vice president, and some of the editors. We visited the Doubleday publishers. We saw a lot of the famous buildings like the Chrysler Building, the World Trade Center, the Empire State Building, St. Patrick's Cathedral, Radio City Music Hall, Carnegie Hall. Tomorrow, we're going to see the Statue of Liberty. And the people we've met, Connie Chung, Linda Lavin, Gerald Levin, Peter Moss. I didn't have a lot of experience with famous people before this trip, and I didn't know what to expect. These people don't need anything from us. Still, they took the time to speak to us, sit down, and spend time getting to know us, letting us get to know them. They ate with us, laughed with us, cried with us. They gave us memories to last a lifetime. Lots of people in powerful positions take advantage of those who aren't. Unfortunately, my dad is one of them. My father is an attorney who is an expert at using the big lie to milk the system. When my parents were getting divorced, my father decided he wanted my brother, sister, and me to live with him. None of us wanted to be around our father, let alone to live with him. The court appointed a group of psychologists to decide who we should live with. The chief psychologist had a limp handshake and a weak laugh. This was the stranger who was to determine our fate. He claimed that my mother had brainwashed me into hating my father. The simple truth was that I hated him because he had a ruthless temper. One weekend when my siblings and I were visiting my father, he flew into a treacherous rage. My father locked my brother in the backyard and left him there without food or water. Finally, at the end of the weekend, the time came for us to go home. My brother was incoherent with fear and hunger. He just wanted my mom to hug him close while he wept. I told Mom that Dad had not fed him all weekend. I couldn't find the courage to tell her the rest of the story. Tragically, none of the psychologists understood the pain my father put us through. My brother and sister were ultimately forced to live with him. The court couldn't see my father with his good old boy mask as the evil person he was. He was willing to do anything to get what he wanted. He even bribed the psychologists for a recommendation in his favor. My dad hasn't changed over the years. He continues to say hurtful things to me. And even though I don't live with him, he still is verbally abusive, constantly telling me I won't graduate and that I don't deserve to be a freedom rider. But I am a freedom rider, and being one is an escape from the rest of my life. This trip and being a freedom rider are the most wonderful experiences of my life. Despite everything, I am still graduating in June and entering college in August. I know that my father will try to stop me. I also know that when I become powerful, I will break the cycle of abuse my father started by doing everything in my power to help, not hurt others.
Diary 119. Dear Diary, tonight I met my idol, an ordinary man with an extraordinary gift. In my opinion, Peter Moss is more than just a journalist. He's a hero and living proof of what can be accomplished when good people do something. I remember the first time I read an article by Peter Moss, during my sophomore year right before we met Zlata. The article was in Vanity Fair, and it was titled Ground Zero, based on his encounters in Bosnia. His words were very blunt and vivid. He told tales of hate crimes and atrocities so horrid that I couldn't stop reading. He wrote about men being forced at gunpoint to rape their daughters. It made me wonder what would have happened to Zlata if she would have stayed in Sarajevo. I can't believe Miss G tracked him down and invited him to come meet us at our hotel in New York. I mean, there he was, my idol, right before me. Meeting him was perhaps the most intense moment of my life. I couldn't believe I was in the same room with one of the only journalists who managed to get a one-on-one interview with Slobodan Milosevic. There was something missing from this puzzle that was supposed to be picture-perfect, though. When he was done talking about his experience in Bosnia, I wanted to know something. Before I knew it, I said, "I watch National Geographic on television, and I don't understand how a journalist can just sit and watch an animal die. Is it the same when you're covering a war? Do you simply sit and watch people die?" The room became silent. Some of the Freedom writers were shocked by my question, and others seemed to be offended on Peter's behalf. But I just had to know. After the silence, Peter began to explain how he often has to push his personal views aside and not get involved. He told us that anything he did other than being a journalist could upset some wicked balance. If he got involved in a dangerous situation, he would not only jeopardize the lives of the people he was trying to help, but his life and the life of his crew as well. If he were to be killed, his death would ensure that there would be more Bosnias. After he was done explaining his role as a war correspondent, I felt content. Now I have an even greater respect for his courage. He wasn't letting evil prevail by watching and doing nothing. By writing about the images he saw in Sarajevo, he was ensuring that no one would deny that ethnic cleansing was taking place and that thousands of innocent men were being taken to their deaths. Tonight I met my idol, Peter Moss. I can't believe it. Diary 120. Dear Diary, and the Pimp of the Year award goes to our agent, Carol. She has helped us set foot into a door filled with new opportunities. If not for Carol, we would have never thought that we could actually publish our classroom diary. Carol got the name Pimp because the first time we met her, someone asked what an agent's role was, and the answer was, she's like a pimp. Not to mention the fact that she was wearing a red jacket, a fedora, a cane, and had a French chauffeur. Really? I was somewhat confused when they said that she was like a pimp. My vision of a pimp is someone who is the complete opposite. To me, a pimp is a tall, smooth-talking, middle-aged man who uses his slick ways to manipulate the minds of young women, not a 5-foot-tall Jewish grandmother. Carol is smart, witty, and she knows how to play the game. From what Ms. G has told us, she will not take any money from us, and she is helping us out of the kindness of her heart. From what I saw of her today, I trust her and believe she'll look out for us.
Diary 121. Dear Diary, the Freedom Writers are finally being published. I am overjoyed the publisher will be Doubleday, since they also published Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl, the second most read book in the world, topped only by the Bible. All of this is like a dream come true. I have loved writing since I could remember. When I read my first V.C. Andrews book, Dawn, I tried to write my own book. I was impressed with her story. Mine was almost exactly like hers, except for the names of the characters. I got to the 13th chapter and decided that I needed to develop my own writing style. The poet in me evolved from attending political meetings with my stepfather and his comrades. My first poem was titled The American Dream, a tale of a woman immigrating to this country, the land of unlimited opportunity, and barely being able to feed her family. My stepfather was proud of me. He did everything but laminate the poem. I continued to write. Each year my poems became more and more mature. I wonder if it was the same for Toni Morrison and Louise Erdrich, two of my favorite writers. When I told my stepfather about Doubleday publishing the Freedom Writer's Diary, you can imagine his response. Doubleday, he said, they are one of the biggest publishing houses. His friends, all of whom he told as soon as I told him, are thrilled because I will be added to the short but ever-growing list of African-American female writers. It is scary to be launched into the publishing world. I hope this will be the beginning of a new me. After years of simply writing to purge myself of pain, I look forward to sharing my writing and no longer imagining myself as the starving artist. Diary 122. Dear Diary, as we stood around the room in a group waiting to take a picture with Connie Chung, Ms. Gruelle announced something to us that would change our lives. We had a book deal with one of the most prestigious publishing companies in the world. At that moment, I realized that if we want to be successful, we'll have to work as a team. I know from my own personal experience working as a team can bring a lot of pressure, especially when you are a star athlete. Which brings me back to my junior year when we went to the second round basketball playoffs and were expected to make it to the championship. Before the game, I went into my coach's office to talk to her. She said that she knew we could beat the other team. It was just a matter of our going out and doing it. But she warned us not to get too cocky. I guess I was feeling pretty cocky, because her words didn't faze me. After all, we were the league champs. The papers loved us, and college scouts were sending me letters like crazy. As the team captain, things always came easy for me. So I just assumed it came easy for everyone else. I was wrong. I was getting dressed for the game. I started feeling more pressure than usual. This was just a game, wasn't it? Why was I so nervous? I felt like all the pressure was on me, not the team. My hands started to sweat, and my stomach felt like it had a million knots in it. When we arrived at the other school, I felt like my insides were ready to explode. As I talked to my teammates, I looked into their eyes and saw the fear bottled up inside them. As we warmed up, all I kept saying to myself was, "We have to win. We came too far and worked too hard not to." During the jump ball, my stomach erupted. I tapped the ball and the crowd went ballistic. At first, we looked like the mini dream team, but our dream only lasted for about 10 minutes, a quick 10 minutes. That's when all the pressure came back on me. I felt like it was me against the other team. But in reality, I had four other players on the court with me. In my coach's eyes, I could see her agony. We were losing. It seemed as though she wanted to be on the court with us. At that point in time, I knew it was all up to me, since nobody else wanted to do the job. I felt like I had to save the game. It was all on me. There were only 4 minutes left in the fourth quarter, and we were down by 5 points. All I could see was my team falling apart. It looked like there was no hope. I tried to help my team win the game, but they'd given up. How could they give up? This was the big game. We were supposed to win. I was not about to lose. With 2 minutes remaining, my coach called a timeout. During the timeout, the looks on my teammates' faces were astonishing. The cocky faces I'd seen earlier were now of despair. I thought to myself, is there really hope? Yes, I had to pull this off. I hate losing. And in front of all these people, especially our fans, I had so much tension and pressure resting on my shoulders. Time was running out. Could I save it? The time ran out. The game was over. And I didn't save it. Even though I scored 24 of our 37 points, I felt like I let my team, my coach, and my fans down. I felt like it was all my fault. I started to cry. After the game, as I got dressed, I realized it wasn't my fault, or any one person's for that matter. It was the whole team's fault. We went into the game thinking it was already ours, and when it wasn't, we fell apart. This year we are in the playoffs, and we are not going to fall apart. We've put too much into it, and now we're playing our best basketball, and we are working as a team. It doesn't all rest on my shoulders. For our book to work, we have to work as a team. It can't be one star athlete and 149 bench warmers. Miss G can coach us, but she can't play for us. Just like the saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink.
Diary 123. Dear Diary, today Mrs. Gruel was in New York to meet with our book publisher, and we had a substitute. Whenever a class has a substitute, chaos is imminent. When someone took my chair, I exploded. Maybe it was pent-up frustrations, or could it be that not all freedom writers are carrying their workload? This can't be possible. Or could it be? I am reminded of a story Ms. Gruel read in her sophomore class, and I recently saw on video. The title was Animal Farm. This story revolved around the premise of creating a utopia where everyone is treated fairly and is completely equal. The reality of this is that, just like in the book, not everybody works the same or cares the same. It's not an equal environment. We can safely refer to the Freedom Writers as a Freedom Writer farm, entirely consisting of what we like to call boxers and mollies. A boxer is a hard-working person, and a molly would be the opposite. Molly is the name of one horse in the book Animal Farm. She was a white horse who wore ribbons in her hair and felt as though she didn't have to contribute to the cause. Boxer is the name of another horse in Animal Farm. He was a plain horse who was born strong and sturdy. He put his all into everything he did. He worked so hard that he became as stubborn as glue. The reward for being involved with the creation of a book and being part of something that can change one's life is right in front of the mollies, and yet they do not take advantage of it. They expect others to carry the workload for them. The mollies of the world have to realize one thing, that a boxer can only do so much. Our lawyer, our teacher, and Carol are all here to make our book an all-for-one, one-for-all type of operation. However, the irony is that humans, like the animals in Animal Farm, do not work equally. If this is the attitude, then everything is destined for failure. Ms. Gruel says that the only way the Freedom Writers could be destroyed is from someone on the inside. That is just it, plain and simple. These people, the Mollies, need to get their act together or get the hell out.
Diary 124. Dear Diary, I never thought I would be kicked off the basketball team, especially my senior year. I have devoted 4 years of hard work to my coach and my team. 4 years of early morning practices, late night practices, summer league practices, and winter break practices. Who knows how many laps I had to run, how many side aches I've endured, not to mention all the verbal abuse I've encountered. To sit and watch my teammates win CIF championship from the stands? I don't think so. I have always been a key player on the team. My teammates worked hard with the help of my attitude and motivation. I knew what it took to get them pumped up. So why was my coach kicking me off the basketball team? On one hand, my attitude was beneficial to fellow teammates. I would whisper things to girls on the team to make them mad, and also to make them play harder. That same attitude was the one my coach didn't like. Yeah, I have an attitude. Yeah, I'm sarcastic and mouthy. I will be the first to admit it. But what 17-year-old isn't? I am me, and I am not about to change my attitude for Coach or anyone else. Coach didn't like the looks I made. She always thought I was trying to upset her. She always thought I was talking about her when she turned around. She would say stupid things, and all the time the team started laughing. Coach thought I was making them laugh, but it was her. I should be a bodybuilder with all the push-ups and suicides she made me do. I know I have talent, and I have always wanted to play basketball in college. But who was going to notice me sitting in the stands? All I could think about was, why was she doing this to me? I just can't be a conformist like most of the girls on the team. For 3 weeks straight, I swallowed my pride and walked into my coach's office to discuss my removal from the team. At times, I thought she understood where I was coming from and would give me another chance. I never did get back on the team. She gave up on me, and I felt as though life had as well. Basketball was the only consistent thing I had in my life. It was how I relieved the stress of everyday life. I could go to practice and forget everything outside the gym. Basketball was everything to me. I loved it. It was my life. Though I didn't play for my high school, I went to every game. I watched them win the league championship. I watched them go to CIF. And I watched them go to the championship game. I dealt with the pain of not playing and sat in the stands. I wanted my coach to know that she may have given up on me, but I would never give up on my team. My self-esteem and my confidence are low at this point, but I haven't given up, especially not with my old teammates coming and telling me how the coach would use me as an example. When the girls would practice lazy or not play with intensity, she would say, "Girls, you should work hard." Joan would work very hard to get back on the team. The fact that I was not playing basketball anymore opened up the door to another opportunity for me. I was able to become more involved in the activities that I was only giving a quarter of myself to. One of those activities was the Freedom Riders. When I was kicked off the team, the Freedom Riders were asked to come to New York to receive the Spirit of Anne Frank Award and also to tape a segment for Primetime Live. There were only a few of us that were allowed to go. We had an option, either write a paper on why you should go to represent the Freedom Riders, or we didn't have to go. I chose to write. I knew that some of the girls on the basketball team really wanted to go, but due to the fact that there was a game in a couple of days, they were not permitted to go. That decision was not made by Ms. G, but by the coach. I always believed that for every bad thing comes a good thing. My attitude is better these days. I bite my tongue a lot. I now know that attitude is everything. I'm not perfect. No one is. But I'm trying. Like Ralph Waldo Emerson said, to improve is to change. To be perfect is to change often. I am far from perfection, but I'm changing. Diary 125. Dear Diary, what the heck just happened? Out of 150 Freedom Riders, I have been chosen to speak in front of Barbara Boxer, our senator. Why me? Why would the Freedom Riders want the most outrageous student and the whole group to represent them in front of someone who could change their lives forever? The thing that really trips me out is that it wasn't just Ms. Gruel who decided that I should be the keynote speaker. It was also the other 149 Freedom Riders who, for some strange reason, believed in me. From the beginning of my freshman year up until this very day, I have had to be the center of attention. My freshman year, I had the whole gothic image going on and thought I was a vampire. I pierced my nipple and my mother nearly had a heart attack. I was on restriction for a month. My sophomore year, I told everyone that I was a fairy, and with fairy characteristics, I fluttered out of the house without parental consent. I got locks put on my windows and was restricted for a month. My junior year, I was totally out of control. I wanted to rebel in any way that I could. I cut class almost every day. I shaved my long blonde hair off and dyed the little bit that was left jet black. Unfortunately, I forgot to put Vaseline around my face and ended up with black dye stains dripping down my face for about 2 weeks. That took 10 years off my mom, and I got restricted for another month. If that wasn't enough, I later pierced my tongue and had the very blasé, I don't care about life attitude. At 16 and a half, my mom found out I was cutting classes with my 21-year-old boyfriend. She threatened to put him in jail, and I was on restriction 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, possibly forever. It didn't matter. Those restrictions were getting quite old. I snuck out of the house anyway, and almost went to jail myself when I got caught outside past curfew by the cops. What made me realize that I should slow down on my wild streak is when Ms. Gruel threatened to kick me out of the Freedom Riders. That got my attention, fast. I depended on the Freedom Riders to always be there, and I was tongue-tied when Ms. G got fed up with my crazy antics. I was putting everything else before my education, and she would not put up with it. I still can't see why they chose me to speak to a senator instead of a Freedom Rider who deserved it. Well, I'm not going to let down the Freedom Riders, Ms. G., and especially not myself.
Diary 126. Dear Diary, I yelled Viva los Freedom Riders in front of an audience of university professors at UC Irvine's Pursuit of Peace conference today. I can still hear that writers part echoing in my head. I was hoping to hear laughter from Freedom Riders in the audience because usually they're the only people who laugh at my antics. But the entire crowd burst into laughter. Hysterics, actually. I even got a standing ovation. How odd. This has never happened before. People usually laugh at me, never with me. Ironically, the last time I was at UCI, I was in their child development center being treated for ADD when I was 8 years old. At the time, I was trying to understand what ADD meant. I had no idea what it was. All I knew was that it was controllable and wouldn't affect my work habits if I take the prescribed drugs. I didn't pay much attention to ADD when I was young. Now I have learned that it could stay with me until I die. Because of my ADD, I have done some wacky stuff in the past, where, unfortunately, there were no standing ovations. I remember a time when I was young and I charged full steam ahead into a Coke machine. Look out! Here comes the raging bull. Everyone was looking at me. I was out of control and on a rampage. Bang, bang, clank, bang. The banging and the clanking was my head crashing against the soda machine. Next thing I knew, I was lying on the floor while everyone was getting free Cokes. This is not the sanest way to gain popularity. Most people would use quarters to get soda, but I used my head. Not the normal thing to do, huh? The Coke fiasco was a result of not taking my medication. I take Ritalin to control my disorder. It's small, but it packs a punch. It has the power to control me, like a lasso on a horse. The medicine goes into effect 30 minutes after consumption, but if I forget to take it, the effects afterward are unpredictable. For instance, one time I went to my garage and started to hit the punching bag with my head. Then my fists. I had no anger or frustration that needed to be released from my body. There was no reason for me to be out there. You could say that I was just killing time. When I was younger, I was constantly the butt of everybody's jokes. I had to get attention because nobody liked me or tried to be my friend. Now that I'm grown up, I don't have to try so hard because friends come naturally. I'm surprised that I could make a highly intelligent audience laugh. A bit of comic relief, so to speak. What's good is that the professors didn't try to alienate me from the rest of the Freedom Riders. Maybe they saw something special in me that my other teachers had never seen before. Now I can't wait to start college because there are all types of people who are just like me, different and weird. It's good to know that I don't need to change for others, but to search for people who will take me as I am, without any strings attached.
Diary 127. Dear Diary, for the past 4 years, we have been learning about tolerance and how you should accept everyone no matter what. Well, acceptance isn't something that comes naturally for people who have to deal with me. Many people don't accept me when they find out I'm a lesbian. I realized I was a lesbian just recently when my best friend told me that she loved me, and I returned her love. It's funny to think about how dramatically your life can change in a matter of minutes. After coming to terms with who I am, I had so many questions. I was confused and scared and didn't know what to do. What if people found out about us? Would they still accept us or would they turn their backs on us? What would our close friends think when they found out? How would they treat us? Would we still be welcomed in our little social group? What will our families do when they find out? Will they stick by us? And what if the college we will be going to found out? Would we be kicked out of school because of who we chose to be with? After all, it is a religious school, and the bylaws say that homosexuality will not be tolerated. After all these questions ran through my mind, I was even more scared and confused. I couldn't answer half of them, and the other half I already knew the answers to, but didn't want to face them. This experience has led me to believe that the people who always tell you that they are your friends, no matter what, are really the first ones to go. When I told a few of my friends that I thought I could trust, they were the ones that had the biggest problem with me. They told me I was going to hell, and that they didn't want anything to do with me. The few family members we told had no problem with our sexuality. The hard part will be when the time comes to tell our parents. My mom has told me she would love me no matter what, but when it comes down to it, will she? Or will she be like some of my friends and leave? Diary 128. Dear Diary, me? Prom queen? I can't believe this. This has been the best night of my life. I feel like Cinderella. Everyone was so excited for me, but all I could think about doing was calling my mom. For some reason, I knew it would mean more to her than it did to me. It wasn't so much that I wanted to tell her that I had won, but instead I wanted to thank her and dedicate the whole night to her. You look so beautiful with that crown on, my mom said. She stayed up all night waiting for me, just to see me with my crown, sash, and flowers. You are like a trophy to me. When I saw my mom's tears, it made me realize how much she had sacrificed for me to be here. I never really understood the struggle she went through, but now it all makes sense to me. My family was very wealthy in my country. Because my parents were so high up in the government, my brothers attended one of the best private schools, and my younger brother and I had our own babysitters. My mother owned one of the best beauty salons at the time. She had very important clients who were involved with the government and the entertainment business. My parents were always working, and we were left most of the time with our babysitters. Getting good grades was always expected from us due to the schools that we attended. We had everything there was, except the family bonding. I was born in Nicaragua, a country where a communist regime was implanted after Somoza lost his presidency. When communism spread, my family was in danger because their political status changed. My father, being the accountant of the Somoza family, was automatically considered an enemy. My two older brothers were at a higher risk of being forced to join the army because of their ages. Young boys were taken away from their families to be brainwashed in a communist doctrine and trained for war. We were living a life of darkness and without hope. Something had to be done quickly. My mother was 6 months pregnant when she decided that she would have to be the one to immigrate to the United States with my brothers because my dad was constantly being watched. My mother had to leave everything behind. She gave up her money, her business, the good life that she had. But most important, she had to risk leaving her 3-year-old daughter and her 6-year-old son behind. My mother had to decide whether to risk her life for her two older sons or stay and watch her sons and husband die in a war. She couldn't take us all with her. First of all, it was a lot of money, and second, it would have been too obvious if we all had left. My innocent mind couldn't understand what was going on at the time, though. I didn't understand why she was leaving me behind. My father, brother, and I waited about a year before we reunited with my mother, my two older brothers, and my new baby sister. That was one of the best feelings that I had ever felt in my entire life. Both of my parents knew that coming to the U.S. was going to be really hard. Not only was our lifestyle going to change dramatically, but they also knew they would have to start from scratch. Indeed, when we came to the U.S., we were practically just another number added to America. Although we hadn't been a real family before, in that moment it felt as if we could never be apart. From that time on, we have had several difficulties trying to adapt to a culture that wasn't ours. My parents have worked very hard to still give us the good life that we once had. We don't have all of the materialistic riches we once had, but now we have something much more valuable than we had before. I never quite knew about my heritage or the positions that my parents had in the government until we started talking about my culture in Ms. Gruel's class. Everything was actually a shock to me when I found out the reason why we had to leave Nicaragua. It was as if it had happened in a past life. Ms. Gruel encouraged me to talk with my mom about what had happened. When my mom was fixing my hair before I left for the prom, I kept thinking that those two hands that were touching my hair were the very same hands that made her very successful in our country. I never really appreciated her sacrifice until tonight. I didn't realize that I had a very important person right before my eyes. Not only did this person risk her life for me and my brothers, but it is also the person who has supported every decision and every accomplishment that I've succeeded at. I would have never had the opportunity to be prom queen if my mom didn't risk her life to bring us here. Now when my mom calls me her trophy, she means that I am her most valuable possession. That's why I feel that this crown is really for her. She is the real queen. Diary 129. Dear Diary, we just won an award from the American Jewish Committee called the Micah Award for fighting injustice in our society. On the cover of the invitation, it said, "Whoever saves one life saves the world entire." This statement is without a doubt one of the most powerful things I've ever read. Because of silence, the Nazis tormented 6 million innocent souls to death. Because of silence, over 1 million people perished during the Reign of Terror by the Khmer Rouge. Because of my silence, 2 innocent little girls were sexually abused. Silence ensures that history repeats itself. Winning the Micah Award inspired me to make a drastic change in my life and not be silent anymore. After 9 years of suffering, I finally decided to take the step I feared most, speaking out.